Welcome to Locked On Heat. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm joined here by David Ramil. We're two credentialed NBA writers and the hosts of the only daily Miami Heat podcast that you're going to find. Locked On Heat is a 20 to 30 minute show that covers the Heat 5 days a week. We've got recaps, we've got the biggest storylines, and the best analysis around. So subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Now let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
On today's edition of Locked On Heat, we're joined by former Heat reporter for the Miami Herald and ESPN, Michael Wallace, who covered the team during the Big Three era. It's a great conversation as we reflect on what was one of the more exciting times in Heat history.
So much to talk about. A great conversation about the evolution of Dwayne Wade's career, the most defining moment of LeBron James's tenure during the Miami Heat, and of course, the lasting legacy of the Big Three era. Now let's get to the show.
We're here with Michael Wallace, senior editor of Grind City Media and former Miami Heat Big Three beat reporter. Michael, you've been covering Memphis for a few years now, but you did live in Miami for a period of time, I'm sure. And I want to know what you miss most about Miami, and you cannot say the sunshine because that's everybody's cop-out answer.
Okay, so can I say the beach then?
No.
Can I say the sand? Can I say the water? Okay, so if I can't, if you got to take all of those off the table, then I definitely will say the diversity of the city. You know what I mean? Just the vibrant cultures that are around there. You know, you can go from one neighborhood to the next and feel the love and the passion and just the diversity. I mean, you see different cultures, you see different ways of life. And I think for me, that was big at the time when I was there. I was in Miami for 10 years. And I lived in both Broward and Dade. I lived in Broward for my first 4 years there. And then I moved down to Miami-Dade, you know, bought a house down there and just loved it for my last six. So, you know, I miss it so much just for a lot of different reasons. But even if you take away the sun, the sand, and the beach and the water, just the people and the food and the cultures, man, I just can't get that out of my system. I look so forward to getting back down there.
So did you cover the Heat for those 10 years that you were down there?
All 10. My first four, I went down there. As a matter of fact, I started right when the Shaq and Dwayne Wade-led 2006 championship team had their championship parade. And Shaq had the, you know, the water gun, the water soakers and all of that kind of stuff. And when they had their parade, that was my first day basically starting. Backing up Israel Gutierrez, who was at the Miami Herald as the lead beat writer. I was his backup my first year. And then, you know, Israel moved on and wanted to do columns, and then I became the beat writer midway through, actually, probably 6 months into my time there. And so I took it from 2006 all the way to 2016. So I had a great run from, like I said, from the first championship team all the way through the LeBron James and Dwayne Wade championship teams and the aftermath of those teams as well in terms of the Chris Bosh medical issues and the Dwayne Wade departure. So that was my that basically encapsulated my 10-year run with the Miami Heat.
So that seems like a good place to start there, because obviously, you know, as your tenure covering the team kind of runs, coincides alongside Dwayne Wade's there. So how do you see his evolution since you started covering the team? Obviously, he was still a young kind of growing player alongside a superstar like Shaquille O'Neal, but his evolution through the years leading up to the Big Three era and even beyond that, really. But how have you seen his growth, and what was it like covering him in person and seeing that kind of evolution taking place firsthand?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that comes to mind as you were saying that was just self-made. I mean, this guy was a self-made superstar. He didn't come into the league as a superstar. I mean, there were other guys that overshadowed him in terms of popularity and size and talent level and all of those things. When you look at, obviously, LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony and Chris Bosh, those guys were the forerunners. And even at the time, Darko Milicic, you know, was the foreign. It's funny how we look at, you know, every year there's a foreign player that comes over, and before he gets here, he's supposed to be the greatest foreign player ever. So even going back to 2003 when it was Darko, I'm saying that now as a lot of people talk about Luka Doncic now coming back over this coming draft. But Dwayne was a guy that came in. We knew that he had experience. He was the elder statesman of that rookie class, basically, having played 3 years at Marquette. And the way he made himself, he wasn't a natural point guard. He played point guard his first year, got the Heat to the playoffs basically as a point guard. You know, when he needed to play shooting guard and small forward, I mean, he's basically done everything he needed to do and until the injury started to set in and really had a nice, great run there. So to see him work his way into being a superstar based on his work ethic and his confidence and his swagger and everything he's done off the court in terms of a business approach and just even from fatherhood. I mean, he's had some issues, man. I mean, this is a guy that Dwayne isn't just one thing. He's many things, and he's had many stories that had to be written from a critical standpoint as well as an accomplishment standpoint. And just the complete package of Dwayne Wade is what stands out about him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that we're noticing now is he's kind of changed the narrative as he returns to Miami and everything else like that. It's kind of been a goodwill tour for him to come back to the organization with which he started. But a lot of people have forgotten the evolution of his career, as you mentioned, going from a self-made player. And in particular, those 2 years there in between the Shaquille O'Neal era and the Big Three era, where he was an MVP candidate, to be honest with you. And a lot of people tend to overlook just how great he was, both offensively and defensively. So that's always something I'm curious about, is, you know, thinking, seeing how other people kind of remember that great time period there for Wade's evolution. But another guy, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, no question about that. I mean, you and I sort of smoothed over that process. But yeah, that 2 year period from, you know, basically 2008 to 2010, Dwayne Wade was a top five player in the league. No question about it. He was most outstanding player of the 2008 Olympic team, coming off the bench. I mean, he led that team coming off the bench to a gold medal. And you know, he was third in MVP voting. Probably could have won it if the Heat had, you know, gotten a few more wins. They won 43 games that season. But he was so frustrated. I remember him talking about how angry he played at that time because he felt like this was the prime of his career and the roster didn't reflect what he needed to get him to that next level. You know, that was during the draft with Michael Beasley and Mario Chalmers, and it was a sort of a dip. And that basically sped up the process of Pat Riley saying, hey, let's get this man some help while he's still in the midst of his prime. And lo and behold, 2010, you know, the rainbow hit, the rainbow falls out of the sky, and it's LeBron James and Chris Bosh. So yeah, that was a great period.
Yeah, absolutely. So another guy who's kind of evolved over that same time period, and I'm glad to see that you mentioned how, you know, you had covered the team during the Pat Riley era, but that was the guy who took over for Riles, and that's Eric Spoelstra. I'm curious how you, covering the team, what you thought of him as a young guy taking over this team and learning the ropes of what it takes to become a head coach. And, you know, all of a sudden, after just two seasons, which he led the team to the playoffs, of course, but to take over a star-laden team like the Big Three, that must have been a hell of a transition for him and for you to cover him.
It was. And I remember Spoelstra being the hip young assistant. He was the guy that, you know, worked his way up, obviously, from the film room. He would come out, you know, after Pat Riley's press conferences and come out and talk to guys in the media. And he would always have his hat backwards. He was the, you know, sort of the surfer mentality kind of guy. And, you know, he always had the smile on his face. And it's funny because you juxtapose that to Spoelstra now, and he's always having this serious look and this expression. But, you know, he's grown up. He's grown into that position. And the thing I'm most proud about, and I can say about Eric Spoelstra in terms of the way that he's sort of matriculated and handled himself, is that he never was intimidated by the job. He knew who he was as a person. He knew who he was as a coach. He knew he put in the hours and the time that it took to earn that position. So when adversity hit, and there was some adversity, you know, dealing with the losses, you know, obviously before LeBron and them came in, and then dealing with the expectations of having LeBron. And there was a time when Spoelstra probably felt like he was on the ropes. But the good thing is that Pat Riley and Mickey Arison was always there to have his back. And you don't see that in a lot of organizations. And I've covered NFL, college sports at the SEC and the ACC level, obviously the NFL and the NBA. And you don't see a lot of coaches get basically groomed for their position and have the patience to withstand that. And the last time Eric Spoelstra came through Memphis, I had a chance to talk to him. And I think he was on the verge of either tying or passing Pat Riley for most wins in Heat franchise history. And I was like, man, I remember when you first started coaching, you know, when you first took over, and for what you've been able to do, man, it's just been remarkable. But it speaks to the organizational structure in addition to Eric Spoelstra's persona and everything that he brings to the job.
Absolutely.
You mentioned the arrival of LeBron James there and how that was such a tough transition, and it kind of started right away. And Of course, it started with that not five, not six, not seven celebration. I want to know, there's obviously been a lot of criticism and attention on that event. In your personal opinion, you were there. Was the criticism of that event warranted?
At the time, I didn't think so, you know, because I was caught up in it, too. I mean, a lot of guys who covered that free agency were working around the clock. I remember being in Las Vegas writing stories at 3 a.m, you know what I mean? Because an agent would call back or, you know, I would get a tip on this and who LeBron wanted to also bring with him and that. And all of that process, I mean, it was just such an emotionally charged time during that summer. And when he finally did it, when, you know, I don't think I got any sleep from the moment from the 2 days leading up to the decision television show, all the way through maybe the first 2 days after. So about a 4 day process, 4 days over the course of that 4 days, I probably got maybe a total of 8 hours of sleep. I mean, that was just, and then when they did the press conference and the celebration, I was backstage. I was like right at the bottom of the stage, and it was the riser. They were actually on the lift when they got lifted up to the stage when they first unveiled the curtain and they came out. And I remember looking at LeBron and seeing LeBron, and I heard he and Dwayne talking, and LeBron was actually nervous about the whole process once when that stage opened up and you saw them three in their uniforms. And he said, man, this feels like a rock concert. It just feels so funny. It feels so strange to be doing this right now. And Dwayne was like, well, you better get ready for it because it's going to be like this as long as you're here. Yeah. And then next thing you know, the stage lifts up and they take the stage and then they go off and start dancing. And the 4-9-4, 9-5, 9-6 happens. But, you know, when you back away from it, it was a premature celebration. I mean, you know, most teams have that kind of celebration after they win a championship. Well, the Miami Heat won the championship of relevance when it came to that July signing day, and everybody watched it. I mean, it's like we criticize things, but we still glued to the TV. Right. You know, the decision got heavily criticized, but everyone was still sitting there watching it and just on every single word that he said. Same thing with that press conference that they had. And then the real press conference happened after that and business got restored. But, you know, I remember it like it was yesterday, man. The details are flowing right back to me as I'm saying this. And, you know, it was high times definitely to be a writer covering the NBA at that point.
There's a reason that there was so much emotion around that. I mean, the decision that was it was one of the biggest decisions ever in the NBA as far as a free agent decision goes. And LeBron joining Miami in the peak of his powers. I mean, you look at LeBron's career, and obviously he's still doing it now with Cleveland. He's still probably the best player in the NBA. I'd argue he is still the top player in the league. But he was also, you know, you look through his career, he's probably had so many peaks and primes. But was that 2010 to 2014 sample size kind of like, do you think that was the best of LeBron James during those 4 years?
I think that was the best of LeBron in the role of having to be the clear score number one guy. You know what I mean? I think now his role, I mean, he's dominant this year from a facility. He's still leading. That's the thing, though. It's like, you know, you can't just box LeBron into one category because he's such a dominant player across the board. You know, but I think when he married and merged his offensive talents as a scorer primarily with his defensive tenacity, that was the best 4 year stretch that he's ever had. And I think he was complimented, particularly with the last, you know, those middle 2 years, with the best supporting cast that he's ever had in terms of what fits him. You know, I mean, people overlook, you know, I know Mike Miller was hurt a lot of that time, but what Mike Miller was able to do for LeBron James in terms of spacing the floor and just the mindset. Mike Miller was a guy that kept the locker room light, and guys used to always joke around because it was tense moments. So everybody in that role and that on that roster had a specific role to make that team great. You know, I think about Shane Battier when he came in and really, really showed the guys what true sacrifice is about. I might not get any numbers whatsoever except for the two charges that I'm going to take in the fourth quarter, and that's going to help us win a game. And when you have Shane Battier sacrificing everything to do that, you know, that shows his greatness. But what all of that did was, you know, you move around furniture in certain places and put them in prime positions to accentuate the middle piece or the centerpiece. And that's what the Heat roster did around LeBron. I think they bought out the best in him, and he in turn bought out the best in them because he was at his best, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
I mean, you there was the 27-game win streak, the two straight finals wins. I mean, there were so many great, like, just big-time moments of that team. What was the most incredible thing that you saw LeBron do during that time?
No question about, and it's funny because I could name 20 things right off, you know, just without even really thinking. But the one that I hold way above everything else was Game 6 in Boston Garden, yeah. When he had the 45-point, 16 rebounds, whatever assist it was that night, and the Heat were facing elimination. They were down 3-2 going into Boston in the second season. And he was, you know, Miami would have gone 0-2 in terms of they wouldn't have won the championship in either one of their first years. And this whole thing could have fallen apart at that stage. There was talk about how Pat Riley was going to have to trade Chris Bosh and break up the big three and all of that. But when LeBron walked into Boston Garden, and there's a poster, there used to be an oversized photo outside the Heat locker room after the game. He was crouched over grabbing his shorts, and he had this like this demonic glare in his eyes because he was in such a zone that night. And, you know, I remember writing in Boston Garden that night, just talking to different people who had different vantage points of how locked in that guy was. He didn't talk to his teammates before that game at all. You know what I mean? He just went straight to work. He didn't say anything on the court whatsoever. He just went out in super destroyer mode. And, you know, I'm sitting there talking about it right now, and I'm thinking about, you know, that game and how he dominated that game from start to finish. And that still was a strong Boston team. I mean, that team in Boston had no reason to fold the way they did. But that was, to me, of all the games I've seen LeBron James play, to me, that was the best game that I've ever seen him play. On both ends of the floor from being locked in. So that moment right there, crouched over, putting away Boston, tying the series up to bring it back to Miami to win in Game 7. To me, that defined LeBron James's legacy and who he is as a winner.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one. That really was a special moment for him. Kind of, I think we'd seen him have dominant games in the past, but never quite so dominant where he kind of understood the gravitas of the moment there, the urgency that he had to do something greater than he'd ever done in order to save not just that game, but the season and perhaps even the team, as you implied. I mean, that was, if Miami loses that series to Boston, who knows how history shapes out. But even with the shadows of 2011 and the NBA Finals, and you know, quite honestly, LeBron did not have a good series against the Mavericks. So I think those were kind of haunting him. But he definitely went through an evolution in that second season with Miami. And it was tremendous to see that and kind of encapsulated by that one particular moment against the Celtics. That was a really big win. I remember a lot of that game, and I think a lot of Heat fans too. But I'm kind of curious about the big three in general, and kind of obviously with the gift of hindsight, what do you think the legacy of this team is? Because obviously they go 2-2 in the finals, but they have so many moments there that I think a lot of fans of the game still remember as being special. And this team is historically great in many views, but perhaps not in some others. Maybe a lot of people see them as kind of the product of how they were assembled and everything else. But what do you think the legacy of this team is?
Yeah, and that's funny because the further we get away from it and the more that you see what Golden State has done,
sure.
I mean, Golden State basically has tarnished in terms of the global aspect, in terms of the panoramic view. I don't think you can ever diminish what any team does in its particular time. But when you talk about teams winning, you know, two and back-to-back, Miami won back-to-back, there was at the time – you know, there was talk about them possibly going on a Bulls-type run, and obviously that turned out to be, you know, silly talk because it never materialized, and then LeBron ended up leaving. But what Golden State has done, you know, after that probably trumps what Miami did in that time. What San Antonio's done over the course of five championships,
yep.
You know, over the span that they've done it, including avenging a loss to Miami, that sort of you know, puts them up there as well. And now, so what the Heat did in that moment with back to back, you got to put them in the class with like the Detroit Pistons winning I think two in a row, and you know, some other teams like that have won two. But the fact that it came together the way it did, it they were the most relevant team in modern NBA, and I'm talking about post Jordan. As much as Kobe and Shaq were great and they won their championships, obviously they were a dynasty, but that was before social media and that was before the global explosion of the game, so to speak. I mean, Yao Ming came and elevated it, and then after that, it's been in every market around the world. But I think what LeBron James and that Miami Heat team did, at the height or at the beginning of the apex of what the social media era was, from what they represented on the court and off. And we got to remember too, you know, as much as we talk about their success on the court, it was LeBron James, Udonis Haslem, and Dwayne Wade who basically became the first team in social media era to start doing social justice awareness things when
Absolutely.
They did the Trayvon Martin hoodie, the hoodie tribute that started a whole realm of stuff. Miami was the first team where LeBron James and Dwayne Wade spoke out about Donald Sterling needing to be removed from the NBA. And that happened. You know what I mean? So that team was relevant on a number of levels, and I think that's what separates them from just your average run, you know, not average, but your super teams that have done some amazing things by winning championships.
You know, I'm reading an advanced copy of the Ray Allen memoir that's due to be published soon, and he talks about that Heat locker room as one of the actually he describes it as the best locker room he's ever been in. And that's impressive considering, you know, he was a young player with the Milwaukee Bucks and Glenn Big Dog Robinson, Seattle, obviously alongside Rashard Lewis, and then Boston with, you know, Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. But in Miami, it was just such an impressive collection. I remember really seeing that kind of chemistry and camaraderie develop over those 4 years, obviously not from the firsthand perspective that you did, but even from a far away perspective, you could really see a genuine concern and chemistry and shared friendship, I think, among the players there. And then that kind of brings me to my next point, which is, how did it all fall apart? I mean, the 2013-14 season on the surface was a successful one, but in hindsight, there was so much going on with Wade going through his maintenance program, Mike Miller having been, traded or cut, Joel Anthony, Ray Allen, you know, was not getting along with Eric Spoelstra, and of course LeBron mulling his future options. What happened there, as far as from your perspective, what you were able to see as far as the dissolution of the Big Three era?
Well, I will say this, as you were talking about, you know, the Ray Allen excerpt, two words stand out about that. And when I say them, it'll take you back to how crazy and zany and fun and energetic that locker room was. The Harlem Shuffle, the Harlem Shake. Remember that?
Absolutely.
The Harlem Shuffle, whatever it was.
Absolutely.
And the Harlem Shake. And I mean, Birdman came in. I mean, he had just gotten there that week.
Yeah.
And he was the star of the Harlem Shake. And then, you know, so that shows you. How it was just, it started off as just two guys talking and saying, hey, what are we doing for Halloween? And what are we going to do here? And they all came in together and created this. And all it took was just one or two guys to have the idea and everyone bought in. Guys from different socioeconomic backgrounds, right. You know, guys from different races, cultures, what have you. The other thing that comes to mind about what you're talking about is this, there's an old saying, there's a thin line between love and hate. The same emotion and the energy that you put in loving someone, when it goes bad, it doesn't just go normal. It doesn't just go neutral. It goes bad. You know what I mean? So
Absolutely.
Because you still put that same amount of love and thrust and passion in it. And when it goes the opposite way, you feel violated. You feel like, you know, what happened? You feel betrayed. And I think because that team put so much of their heart and energy and soul, and it was such a pressure cooker with everything that was expected of them, and then when bodies started not to cooperate, and you got to remember, the Ray Allen locker room was an older team. I mean, Dwayne
Absolutely.
Wade was getting, it's funny because we say that now, Dwayne's still playing, but Dwayne was breaking down. Chris Anderson was, you know, elder statesman at that time. Ray Allen was an older guy. Rashard Lewis was an older guy. And it got to a point where LeBron just got tired of carrying the burden of every night having to be great while everyone else didn't have to do as much. And I think that wore on him as well. Plus, he had some things off the court pulling him back towards Cleveland and Northeast Ohio. And it was just too much. And I think once he realized, okay, I've done what I needed to do here, then the other guys saw it was a trickle-down effect. They caught lightning in a bottle for 4 years for the most part. And then when it was gone, it was gone. I mean, it went away as fast as it came together and as prolifically as it came together, it went away. It's unfortunate, but, you know, and then obviously the medical issues with Chris Bosh took it even further, and it created some dissension there. And ultimately, all three of the Big Three ended up leaving Miami on some pretty heated, animated tones with Pat Riley and the ownership. So, fortunately, we're seeing that the pieces being put back together with Dwayne Wade and the Heat now. And but when we look back on that time, man, it's going to be an amazing 30 for 30 or whatever documentary whenever it's done. I'm just looking forward to seeing it and hopefully participating in it.
Yeah, I always thought either you or Dan Levitard would write a book on it because I thought you had the best perspectives on it, and you were there for the whole evolution of it. And so I always thought that that was something we'd see, you know, sometime right after the era ended. Maybe it ended too soon for that to actually happen. But, you know.
But see, LeBron keeps going on and winning, though. See, the thing is, you know, that was a special era, and that book would sell great in Miami and probably through most of the league.
Yeah.
But then when he went back to Cleveland, I mean, then the other books have been written since then because that was the storybook ending and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it'll be great, though. It's going to be a documentary for sure.
I hear you. You know, one of the things that Ray brought up in that book was how Eric Spoelstra continued to push the team, even though, as you pointed out, they're a little bit of an older group, one of the oldest teams in the league at that time, and that he would go through two-hour shoot-arounds in comparison to just 45 minutes in Boston. And, of course, that's always been the hallmark of this Heat team ever since Pat Riley came in 95. You know, a lot of the narrative surrounding the Heat is the culture and everything else, the work ethic, and it's absolutely it applies. It helps some players, like a guy like James Johnson, who's been a journeyman. He can come in there and find his path, and it takes him to another level, helps him progress. But do you, from your perspective, ever think that maybe the Heat culture is a little too inflexible?
No, I don't think. Once you set the standard and once you have a culture, I think you have to hold yourself accountable to it. You know what I mean? And I've been around enough teams that don't have that. And you realize from the way they run their organization to the way that they demand high level conditioning, body fat percentages have to be in line, diets have to be, you know, adhered to. The workout room has all of the latest state of the art technological equipment, advancements and everything.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, when you're talking about maintaining older players, yes, you have to be smarter about those kind of things. But I also think at that point, Pat Riley was also, and Eric Spoelstra, they were both also trying to fight to maintain their influence on the roster as well. Because, again, you don't when LeBron comes in, he's such a domineering and polarizing figure that he can sometimes have the perception that he's running everything.
Right.
And sometimes you have to push back and say, hey, you deserve to be held accountable too. And these plays, yes, LeBron, I know you can break a play off and still get a basket, but we have to be able to still put our structure in here because I am the coach ultimately. And I think some of that was there towards the end. I thought Pat Riley saying, hey, I'm not going to ease up on this because you don't ease up on greatness. You got to continue to be great. One of Pat Riley's sayings sticks with me to this day. You know, I mean, he always says, you know, there is no way to greatness. Greatness is the way. And, you know, I mean, that means that says a lot. You know what I mean? And it's sort of you juxtapose that with LeBron's motto, which is strive for greatness,
right,
which makes it seem like greatness is a destination, whereas Pat is saying the exact opposite. It's not a destination. It's an everyday step. You know, so that sort of tells you just philosophically where that sort of tug of war was when it came to some of the 2-hour practices and some of the, you know, inflexibility when it came to how long they stayed in certain cities after games and all of those kind of things. That team felt like it accomplished something, whereas Riley wanted to say, hey, I'm comparing you guys to the Lakers of the 80s. The Lakers didn't just do it for 2-3 years. They did it for a decade. And Riley had that mindset. And it didn't end well in L.A. either. I mean, you know, it was some guys that didn't speak to Riley to this day after those L.A. days. And the New York days, too, for that matter. But they always came back around. Bottom line is that, yes, Ray Allen was right. Eric Spoelstra was right. Pat Riley was right. Three guys can be right about the same thing, and it's just different perspectives of how it worked out.
And we know that Ray Allen's a creature of habit. I actually think it's kind of funny that he says that they should have cut down practice time considering how hard Ray Allen just works on his own body and his own, like he practiced the shot. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's funny that he had such an issue with that.
It is. And it's funny how that works out because a lot of guys, when they leave Miami and they put some years between them and they realize, man, that was the best shape I've ever been in.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Shaquille O'Neal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Shaq had gotten bloated and big in LA. They still won. But he had a point to prove when he got to Miami, and it was Miami that got him back down to basic, almost his Orlando playing size. And he came back and had basically what should have been an MVP year and won a championship. Remember, he got back to a championship before Kobe did.
Right.
And, you know, for a while, it was like validation for Shaq. And when you're going through it, you realize how hard it is and you get beat up. But you're right. Workers like Ray Allen and LeBron James, they never really complained about it during the process. it's usually guys that don't have the same level of work ethic as those guys that sort of complain about that part of it.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I talked to Tim Hardaway with the Pistons, and he was talking about how much he'd love to be able to put his guys now through those long-ass practices like the way he did when he was in Miami. And, of course, he can't do that anymore. And he kind of sounded like he resented the fact that you can't really – you know, one, the physicality is gone, and two, that the coaching staff doesn't have as much power as they once did, where you can run players through that kind of, you know, long practice. So that was very interesting. That, again, and he butted heads with Riley, and he had issues – with the whole, you know, body fat testing and everything else like that. But as you pointed out, in hindsight, he misses those days and realizes that they brought out the very best in him as a player.
It does. And it's just like parenting, too. I mean, yeah. You know, you go through your – and I have teenagers now, just going off to college, and, you know, kids in college, and then some younger, you know, younger kids as well. But it's and you remember that when you were, you know, growing up with your parents, if those who were lucky enough to do that and fortunate enough, you know, you didn't often speak the same languages with as your dad or your mom when you were in these formative years, but it didn't start to make sense until after it. You know what I mean? So they planted those seeds in you that basically harvested after the fact. And sometimes it's hard during the process and in the moment, but that's exactly what these Heat teams have been all about, you know, and grinding. And it wasn't as much about the physical nature of the practices as it was about the fatigue and Pat Riley wanting to see what you had when you didn't have much left in the tank. At some point, it's got to be mind over matter. And what kind of mental decisions are you going to make? What kind, you know, what kind of reactions and responses are you going to have? Are you going to push yourself that extra ounce when you don't have anything left to give? And how are you going to be a teammate or a leader at that point when adversity hits? That's what that was all about. Mm-hmm. And that's why those Knicks teams and those Lakers teams and even, you know, the Heat teams and particularly the ones that won back-to-back championships, you know, Oklahoma City didn't even deserve to be on the court with that Heat team in 2012. And the resilience is what got them over the hump against the Spurs in 2013, if you go back to that. So, I mean, they were dead in the water. Ray Allen hits the shot. Chris Bosh gets the rebound and passes out to Ray Allen. The shot goes down, and then they had to come back and win Game 7. People forget about the Game 7 and how that unfolded because of such a theatrics in Game 6. But that's the mental toughness that kicks in once you, you know, reach your limit in those practices and things of that nature when you didn't know you had it.
So you mentioned something earlier I want to go back to, Michael, about when we were talking about the legacy of that Big 3 team and just how great they were. And you did mention something about the Golden State Warriors, how they're doing it now. Specifically, you look at what they're doing with the small ball lineup, Draymond Green playing the five there. I thought that look, the Warriors get a lot of credit, and rightfully so, for being quote-unquote light years ahead and et cetera. But I always thought that those Big 3 Heat teams, specifically in the way that they had the pace and space and Chris Bosh at the five, you know, playing some small ball and having like just basically five shooters on the floor at all times around LeBron James and doing those sort of things. I never thought that group got enough credit for really kind of ushering in this era of small ball, so to speak. I want to know what you would think about and about what Chris Bosh said recently on the Bill Simmons podcast. He said that he kind of wishes that that the Big Three would have stuck together for a fifth year because they would have had a shot at those Warriors teams before Durant, obviously, but with Steph and Clay and Draymond. Do you think that the Big Three could have challenged those Warriors teams?
That's a great question. I mean, that's and it's funny because they didn't miss each other by much. You know what I'm saying? They only missed each other by maybe a year, year and a half, 2 years. I don't think so. I think the Warriors team would have won. I think because by the time you talk about that Heat team coming back, those guys were all older. And then you're also talking about assuming health. Bosh had, you know, a blood clot situation, I mean, that developed during that time. So if we could see, and the thing is, here's what happens. It's like Golden State never likes to be compared to Jordan's Bulls. And it's hard to compare teams of those kind of eras, but I do think it's easier to assimilate the two teams, the Heat team and the Golden State team, at their best. So if you take Golden State's best year and put it against Miami's best year, that lockout shortened 27 game winning streak, you know, type year or whatever they had, I think LeBron at that stage, I would favor Miami because I think they were number one. I thought they were more physical and more versatile than Golden State, and I thought that they locked up defensively a little bit better when they were engaged. Which version of Golden State are we talking though? Because if like the Golden State that you know, I mean, that team that had, you know, pre-Kevin Durant or with Kevin Durant. You know what I mean? It's kind of hard to see which one of those is the best team.
Let's do pre-Kevin Durant.
Ruben, Chris Bosh.
Yeah, pre-Kevin Durant, peak Miami Heat.
Yeah, I would take Miami. I would take Miami. Golden State would definitely make it a great, great series because of their ability to shoot. But the Miami teams that were the best ones in 2012 defended their tails off, man. I mean, LeBron chased down blocks. You had Bosh there. You had some bigs at the rim. Shane Battier, and you had guys. Udonis Haslem was still capable of playing at that point. Just the way they rotated, they were the team that switched on everything too. I mean, that's where Golden State picked up some of that stuff. But you're right. You know, Golden State, you know, they're light years ahead because they have the skill set of superstars doing this. But I go back, Miami did it, moving Bosh out to the five. I remember, you know, D'Antoni's team in Phoenix did it. You know what I mean? They, you know, in terms of pace and space, they just didn't have the closer that either one of the Heat or the Golden State Warriors did. You go back even further than that. The reason why Houston was a great team with Robert Horry and those guys was because Horry played the four. And he stretched it out at the four, and the team could open space too. So, you know, it's we've seen this. You know, the Denver Nuggets of the old school used to do it. Even I mean, this Golden State isn't even the first Golden State team to do it. Don Nelson's Golden State Warriors played the same way. You know what I mean? Up and down and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's they found a way to, you know, to add the 3-point ball and just make it a major, major weapon. But this style has been played before, and the Heat was the one that. They had to switch to it in order to maximize their chances when they were in the midst of that Big Three era.
We've talked a lot about the Big Three, and we appreciate all the insight there. And you've had an up close look at guys like LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, all the guys that we've been talking about here. One name we haven't mentioned yet: Mario Chalmers. And I know that you have an up close look to Mario Chalmers right now. Now, look, I'm sure you don't know this, Michael. Maybe you do, but. Before we started calling this show Locked On Heat, we almost named it Locked On Mario Chalmers, only because David and I have been such Chalmers supporters in the past, and that can't be said for a lot of Heat fans, as I'm sure you're aware. Chalmers was sort of the scapegoat a lot of times. I'm going to clear out here. I want you to tell the listeners right now, what makes a guy like Mario Chalmers so valuable for a basketball team?
Well, I think Mario's irrational confidence is his strength, and the fact that he feels like he belongs on any court, in any rotation, on any team in NBA history is what afforded him well so far in his career. Like right now, he's struggling. I mean, the Grizzlies are in a bad spot right now, and Mario's impact isn't what he wants it to be. He's still, you know, 2 years removed. Actually, this week is the 2-year anniversary of his Achilles tear. When he was traded to Memphis and tore his Achilles. So he's trying to work his way back and become an NBA rotation player on a regular basis again. But on those Heat teams, you got to remember, like, what stands out to me was the fact that Pat Riley stripped the entire roster down in 2010. When all of those guys were free agents and he had to clear the salary cap, there was one dude that he didn't touch on the roster. The entire roster was bare with the exception of one guy, and it was Mario Chalmers. He was the one guy that was left on the roster before they rebuilt it during that summer of free agency because they had to re-sign Dwayne, sign Bosh, sign these guys, sign Udonis. But Mario was the one guy that he did not trade when he purged the entire roster to create that ultimate cap space. So he felt like Mario would have been a good fit, off-the-ball shooter for LeBron, and a defender who can pick up 94 feet on point guards. And that's what Mario Chalmers was. And he knew what his role was. He was the scapegoat. But again, that mental toughness is what Pat Riley is always respected and Eric Spoelstra is always respected. And don't forget, man, I've covered this Heat team long enough to know that Mario Chalmers was basically, they were trying to replace him every year since he was drafted. Mm-hmm. Remember, he was a second round pick, came in, started as a rookie, and then they started bringing in veterans every year to try to unseat them, and it didn't work out until they finally got Dragic in there, you know, a couple years ago. So, you know, for him to be able to play the way he's played and have that mental toughness, and, you know, the ultimate compliment to Mario Chalmers was when they went to the White House and President Obama said, hey, we got to wrap this up before somebody starts yelling at Mario. And for the President of the United States to give you a shout out like that on that star-studded team shows you how valuable Mario Chalmers was.
I always go back to a quote from Eric Spoelstra that when asked about Chalmers' irrational confidence, he goes, well, I'd rather have somebody willing to take the game-winning shot than somebody that wouldn't. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's sort of how he always viewed Mario Chalmers, and I have to agree. Look, Michael, we really appreciate the time. Please plug your Twitter account and any projects that you might have upcoming.
Hey man, listen. We just on. It's hard to plug right now because we have the longest losing streak in the NBA right now in Memphis. But it's certainly what we're doing here is an extension of what you guys are doing with the podcast and what Grind City Media is all about is giving that same heat index type coverage to a singular team. I mean, we created our own media brand and digital media site to cover from broadcasting to podcast to video to audio to written pieces. In Memphis, and so that's what Grind City Media is all about. More and more teams are starting to do some version of this, and I'm just lucky to have the transition that I was having to go from first the Miami Herald to ESPN, staying in Miami, and then coming to Memphis to do this and basically birth this concept here. So Grind City Media at Grizzlies.com is where you can find all of our work, and I'm definitely going to, once the podcast goes live, I'm definitely going to push that out too. Via our Twitter channels and everything else. So just hit me up at my mic check, MyMikeCheck, and you can find all of my work there too.
He's Michael Wallace. He's the senior editor of Grind City Media. We appreciate the time. We appreciate all the work, and we're looking forward to all these new projects too. Thanks for the time, Michael.
Hey, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Again, big thanks to Michael Wallace, senior editor of Grind City Media. This has been Locked On Heat. You could subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For David Ramil, I'm Wes Goldberg. We'll catch you next time.